the Spirit of Jazz podcast, where music dances with mystery, with your hosts, Bill Carter and Jeff Kellum.
Hi, this is Jeff Kellum with the Spirit of Jazz podcast with my co-host, Bill Carter. And Bill, introduce our very special guest today.
I've got a wonderful friend and great musician. This is Donnie McCaslin, a tenor saxophonist, a brilliant improviser. Donnie, welcome to the Spirit of Jazz.
Thank you, Bill and Jeff. It's a pleasure to be with you both.
Tell us a little bit about what you're doing now and where this is taking you.
I'm about a week away from departing on a European tour with my band, and it's really to preview a record that is going to come out in June. It's called I Want More, and it is a selection of songs that I recorded during a period of much reflection. In my case, there was that period of not really knowing what was going to come next, you know, if touring would come back, if live performance would come back, when would it come back, what would it look like? Things like that were all in the air for all of us. In my situation, I really thought about what is it that I want to do? If I can only do one thing, what is that going to be? Prior to that, I'd been touring for a couple of years, a record of mine called Blow that was collaboration with different songwriters. And so touring with a singer, guitar player, and adapting that music for live performance. And it was just so much fun. And I really loved that exploration. But when I stepped back again in this period and I thought about, well, if it's going to be one thing, what's it going to be? And for me, that was getting back to instrumental music, playing the saxophone, and doing my best to have these songs really reflect the state of my being at that time.
And these were your compositions?
For the most part. And some are collaborations with my longtime band members. Jason Lindner is an amazing keyboard player and visionary, and Tim LaFave and Mark Giuliana. And really, Tim and Jason contributed some of the songwriting as well, and contributed in the sense of often when we're just at sound checks, we just start jamming, you know, and I just turn on my phone, you know, and record what's going on. And so, you know, there's one piece that just came to mind, Jeff, when you mentioned that was just something I recorded. Tim got into this thing with the ring modulator and the sound and this really great bass line that was very compelling. And so I recorded it, you know, went back to it at a certain point, and that became a song. So things like that, these serendipitous moments happen when we're together that have given me a lot of fodder to write songs around.
So what you're suggesting here is that jazz composition and jazz improvisation just doesn't come out of sitting in a little monastic cell by yourself or walking under a tree. It's the collaboration. It's the interaction.
Yeah, I mean, I can speak for myself, just that you know, I really feel like I really love being in relationship with people musically and learn so much from it. And like, so what you're talking about, Bill, describes, you know, my experience, which is just learning so much from playing with other musicians, being inspired by them, what they play, what they listen to. And also, of course, having time to reflect, work on my own craft. But to me, there's like a balance. And when it's too much of me by myself in that moment, you know, I don't love it. I don't love it because I feel like I still, the real joyous moments for me happen in relationship on the bandstand with people where that unknown, magical, you know, where these things happen, where you get led into a different direction, you know, where you're just open, you try to open yourself up to the spirit and open yourself up to see what's going to happen. And there's a real letting go with that. And there's a lot of uncertainty with that. You know, there's a lot of risk with that when you're in front of a bunch of people who've come to hear you play and you're not going to necessarily kind of do the same type of solo every night or something. I'm just using kind of a general, you know, way of describing it. But that to me is where so much of the beauty happens, the unexpected moments. And that's a lot of what I strive for when I'm playing with people.
Well, let's talk about some of those relationships. Let me throw you a couple names and you respond to Dave Douglas, the trumpeter.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he called me at a certain point to sub on a gig, a festival gig in New York City. And I had a couple months to prepare and there was going to be no rehearsal and no sound check. As it was a festival gig, it was a line, you know, we call it line check, where you basically get on stage for about 10 minutes and make sure the microphones work. And then you get off stage, you know, and then you wait and you come out and play. And I've been a fan of his for years. He's just a prodigious composer, you know, just so all these different projects, such a visionary. And the particular band I was subbing in, I had gone to see various times. Great, you know, Clarence Penn, Uri Kane, Chris Potter, James Genus. I mean, fantastic band. Love them. So the opportunity came up and I tried to do my due diligence and really prepare and learn the music. And when we got on the stage, it just happened. And it was such a great gig. That was the beginning of a tenure in his band for, I don't know how long, Bill. It was maybe 8 years or something, of a lot of touring and recording. And it was wonderful. I just learned so much from having this real up close encounter with his composition style. During that period, he started a record label and he invited me, you know, to record on his label, and just very supportive and just an inspiring musician. And I just, you know, learned so much from him.
Okay, here's another name, Maria Schneider.
Oh yeah. You have this long, you know, long friendship with her and working relationship. She used to play every Monday at Visione's in New York. I, you know, would go hear the band. This is in the 90s and I had just moved to New York. Eventually, Rick Margitza, who was playing in the group, started calling me to sub for him. So I would, and then I got to know Rich, and Rich would call me. So I ended up going there a lot to play. And it was just funny. In those early days, Monday night was my basketball night. So I would go, and it was a group of musicians, and there was a seminary, I think it was Friends Seminary in Chelsea, that had a really nice indoor court. And so every Monday I was there. So, you know, I had my clock and I would play basketball for about an hour. And then I would, you know, run, grab a taxi and go down to Visione's. And I would often, you know, show up like sweaty. It was not that's not my pre-gig ritual now, but back then, you know, and it was tough, you know, because I had come from this more traditional background playing big band music when I was in high school, an amazing high school program. But, you know, there was so much independence in Maria's writing and this chamber quality that it took me a while to get used to. And anyway, long story short, she invited me to join the band just before they made the record Concert in the Garden. And Rick had moved to Paris and I started playing with her band. And I've been in the group ever since. And it's been, again, having this opportunity to be up close with somebody's process and see how they work. You know, Maria will bring in a first draft of something, and then she'll bring in a second draft, a third draft. You know, she keep working at it, and I'm fortunate enough to be there and to see what she's doing. You know, her work ethic, really, she's just so dedicated, and she's a real champion for creators' rights and for musicians' rights, you know, that transcend her big band. She's got a real passion for the well-being of the creator's life, to put it that way. And so I love her dearly and been a great friend and a great supporter. You know, she's been very supportive of my career and my life. You know, just really love her, respect her a lot.
Having Grammy nominations for best solo on her albums probably doesn't hurt.
Yeah. Well, those were thrilling moments for sure. Yeah. Especially the first time it happened, it was just it felt so out of the blue. Just out of the blue. And so yeah, those are really exciting moments.
How did you find out that you were nominated?
Well, the first time it was back in the day of answering machines. And I was home here in Brooklyn where I still live, and my wife Sarah and I were in the other room. And this is sort of funny to say, like, we don't argue much, you know, but actually we were having a little bit of an argument at that point, you know, and then I didn't pick up the phone. And then I hear Maria kind of screaming into the, Donnie, you got not, you know, and it completely diffused our argument, you know, whatever, you know, thing that was passing in that moment was gone. And we were just both, really excited. It wasn't too long after we had been married, actually. So, anyway, it totally changed the temperature in the room and just a surprise. And Maria was so excited to share the news, which was really, okay, really touching.
Thanks for that.
I'm kind of curious, as a listener and as someone who loves the theory behind this, when she creates a space for you to play a solo, does she just write, "Donnie, create a thunderstorm here"?
Well, it's more
scripted. How much is this?
It depends on the song. I mean, she really sets an environment. Like Concert in the Garden, there's a long piece called the Bulleria's Sulia Rumba. So what I see is this, the chord changes with the different accent. She doesn't necessarily write in the part what to go for, but once we're in rehearsals, she'll use stories and analogy. And in that particular piece, there's a very specific environment that's set by the backgrounds and the spirit of the piece. The challenge for me is finding what feels appropriate for that environment that also is me speaking my truth, so to speak. Not to say I can't do what I want, but there's certain things that feel more appropriate for that environment. And so that's the balance I'm trying to achieve, is knowing it as intuitive, as thoroughly as I can, to give me the freedom to try different things that feel like they're working within this world that she's created. Yeah. And as you know, she gives the rhythm section a lot of freedom, so they can really shape things a lot. And I can too, but I'm always thinking of the bigger picture also.
So it's freedom within restraints.
Yeah, I would say. I mean, on her most recent record, there's a piece called CQ, which is this piece inspired by her father and Morse code. And almost everything in the piece is Morse code signals. It's totally free. And it's with guitar and drums, Jonathan, Blake, and Dan Maunder. But again, when I'm playing on it, I'm also thinking of what's happening around me. And she's laid out a certain aesthetic that she's hoping for, that the solo will project. So there is a parameter there.
We're talking with Donnie McCaslin. He's here on The Spirit of Jazz. Let's listen to a little bit of music. Thank you. For those who couldn't pick up the tune, that's Donnie playing a Christmas carol with a couple of the Presby Bop guys a few years ago at St. Peter's Lutheran Church. A memory I will never forget. Thanks again for taking that gig.
Oh, such a pleasure.
So we've been talking about Maria Schneider, which leads us then to another name relationship you've had, David Bowie. Tell us the story.
Yeah, well, Maria was approached by David Bowie's team about doing something. And it was before she was, well, she was in preparation for one of her records, which is an all-encompassing process for her. And I think at a certain point was debating whether to take this on. And we talked about it and I encouraged her to take it on because it was, you know, it was David Bowie and I thought it would be a great thing for her. So eventually she said yes. And then they started meeting to work on this piece. And at one point she called me and said, hey, you know, David was kind of describing the rhythmic underpinning of what he was hearing for this piece. And I thought of you and I played him your record. And I told him he should do something with you. That was really cool to hear that. And just lovely of her. So we spoke again as she was getting ready to set up the first workshop for their piece and mentioned it again that she had spoken to David and thought he should do something with me and my band. So fast forward to, I guess, I can't remember how, you know, maybe a month later or something, 6 weeks later, she called and said that they were going to come hear me play at the 55 bar. You know, I just, one of those things, I tried not to think about it. At one point, you know, kind of saw them out of the corner of my eye, but just tried to stay focused on the music and the set ended. And that place was a very small club. And so, you know, people came up and then they were gone and that was it. And a couple of days later, we had the first workshop for the David and Maria piece. And that's where I met David for the first time. And then that's where things started.
And where did they go?
Well, he asked me to, you know, write my name and I mean my phone number and my email address in his book. And then the next morning he emailed me and, you know, just in typical David fashion, it was succinct, brilliant, and hilarious. And it was about recording a couple songs together. And it was just stunning. So anyway, I tried to write a response and I had Sarah, can you look at this response? So, you know, it took me about an hour to write him back, like two sentences or something, just trying to get the wording right, you know? And so, you know, I think at some point then we started a lot of email correspondence and I said something like, hey, you know, I'm happy to do more than two songs, you know, as much as you want to do, we're good. And so that led to the making of Black Star. About 6 months later, we got in the studio and we started making Black Star, which was recorded over about a 3 month period, a week each month, roughly, you know, just a transformative moment in my life on a lot of levels. He was just a remarkable person and really embodied a lot of the principles that I've tried to embody as an artist and was just a very genuine human being and generous, you know, and his presence in the moment, you know, was complete. There's many other things I could say about him, but those are the first things that come to mind. He was just a great person. I guess I would say, add this, that there was a couple people that I got to know during that period who had worked with him for many years, his personal assistant and another person. And really, you know, been with him for decades and they just both loved him deeply. And I remember thinking, well, that's a real testament to who he is as a person. If these folks who've been around him for so long, you can see, you know, how much care there was. It was great to see that.
What I'm hearing is your appreciation for the humanity of these composers, these arrangers, and these comrades. I mean, how important that is.
Yeah, absolutely.
So let's ask you the podcast question. What's spiritual about jazz for you?
You know, I think for me personally, my story is that I made an impulsive decision to start playing saxophone when I was about 12. And the thing that it afforded me was the ability to process my feelings and to improvisation, the ability to express things that I didn't have the language to express. It felt like a lifesaver. And you know, it's not like I came out playing like, you know, great or anything. You know, I mean, I don't want to mislead you guys, like, oh yeah, I was, you know, I was 12 years old and I was playing, you know, Giant Steps, and you know, it was you know, it wasn't like that. But even when I was struggling, and of course there's many struggles over the years, but even then, you know, just getting to know the instrument, still there was this, I could feel it, that thing of expression, you know. And you know, unfortunately for me, I, you know, just grew up in a dysfunctional home, and you know, I was unfortunately, you know, lived through a lot of abuse that you don't want to have people live through. So I had all this emotion happening again and not knowing how to process it, you know, and it was awful. But music and improvisation offered this sense of catharsis. So that felt spiritual to me. You know, I mean, growing up in a home that was no spirituality, you know, to speak of, that I had encountered before age 12. I'll put it this way. I think there was a spiritual aspect for me of hearing John Coltrane, and then there's other people I could mention, you know, but that really captivated me and captivated my imagination and sort of transported me to another place. This is something to, you know, for me to strive for. This is worth living for. Things like that. That again, at an age where trying to deal with trauma, but having no idea how to, being on my own, and then having this thing to latch on to that was, you know, so great. And so then, you know, fast forwarding a few years later, and then, you know, just reading about John Coltrane and his life, the author describing John Coltrane as, you know, playing in the room and trying to sort of have this sense of love permeate the room when he played, you know, this, but that not egocentric love, but that the reflection of God's light. I don't know if it's put that way in the book, but you know, that's sort of how I maybe interpreted that. And I thought, you know, that's a life worth living. That's something to strive for that resonates with me forever, wherever I was at 16 or 15 or whenever that was. And so I know that's a long answer to your question, but that's when I think about that, that was the beginning for me. You know, that's what felt spiritual to me about jazz and improvisation, I have to say.
It's beautiful and deep.
I have a question about, you know, you play with folks, you play with the other musicians, you play for folks. Mm-hmm. Do you play just for yourself?
Yeah, I do. And you know, and Jeff, it really goes back to the beginning for me of improvising offered me kind of feels like a lifeline, you know, just of, you know, I would play by myself and practice, you know, and practice diligently. And of course, not every practice session was a cathartic experience, as any musician can tell you. But I would pick up the horn and just play, and it would help me to process my feelings and try to come to terms with that and to heal from that. And I would say even to this day, music still does offer me it. There's something about that to your question, you know, just playing and when I get lost in it, it feels like it rearranges the brain chemistry, you know, when I'm done, or releases some of those endorphins, and I feel so much better. And that's been it for me for decades, no matter what the suffering I've gone through or whatever, I've always felt that's been something for me that has offered that relief, you know. So just eternally grateful for it.
Yeah. Imagine playing the joy one day and playing the pain the next, and
yeah, that's right, absolutely, you know, and there's so much hope in music, you know, too. It's just a pleasure to participate in that, you know. And I guess I think about that, you know, in those, the most egoless moments, because they're not all egoless, of course, but like, you know, when it's, you feel it's purest, you feel like you're just wanting to be, you're wanting to reflect the light of God into the world, and through the music, and it's selfless, and you're just there, and it's just, you're just a part of this, you know, this light moving around, and that's a beautiful thing.
We must go back to your new album. I mean, we have to.
Yeah.
Have to do,
Yeah. Tell us about the new album and what's next.
Oh, sure. You know, born out of all that, you know, reflection and thinking about what's meaningful to me and what I would like to have more of in my life and to live a fuller life, you know, to live without as much angst and to live more fully in the moment and to feel, you know, more grounded in every moment and all the things that are around that. So this music is reflective of that, as much as it can be. And it's, I couldn't be happier with how it came out. It's it feels like the most honest expression of who I am as an artist and how this group of musicians has evolved and our interplay over the years. And mm-hmm. there's so much that goes into it. And I just feel so happy with this representation of it in this moment. And I guess what else can I say to describe it? It's, you know, it's a hybrid of musical styles in a way. You know, it's electric music and the saxophone is treated and it's not an acoustic jazz record, but it's also not a rock record. And it's also not really a fusion record in the way that I think of fusion when people bring up those categories. Yeah. June 16th is coming out on Edition Records.
Donnie McCaslin, thanks so much for talking with us today. We're going to follow you. We're going to check out this new album, but we're going to hold you close in our hearts. The work that you do, thank you so much.
Well, thank you both. It's really been a pleasure to spend this time with you, and I appreciate the great questions and the conversation.
All the best to you.
Likewise. Take care.
Thanks for listening to the Spirit of Jazz podcast. This is a production of Presby Bop Music. To find out more about Presby Bop, our music, concerts, and recordings, please explore our website at www.presbybop.com. And send us a note telling us what you think about the Spirit of Jazz. We'd love to hear from you. Check in with us again next time. I'm Jeff Kellum.
And I'm Bill Carter. Thanks for tuning in.